Welcome to Victoria Rumble Room, a show that brings you all sorts of information from Vancouver Island, British Columbia, across Canada, around the world. I'm Robin Adair, and we are talking about all kinds of interesting things because it's 2024, a new year is upon us. And as usual, I'm joined by my co-host with the most, John Jurisic, for another year. And Johnny, this is an election year in BC.
Sure is, Robin. There's going to be lots and lots of chatter throughout the year. Of course, you and I are not getting any older. That is, definitive. Although we don't know when the writ will be dropped, we happen to think it'll be this year. And I think earlier than later. Premier EB wants.
Well, it's going to be this year. It has to be this year.
Premier EB, he wants lots of time to roll out his housing strategy. But wouldn't that be convenient if the right was split? No, nonetheless. So while he might be calling an election sooner than later, we're really not expecting it till the fall and this year. So stay tuned for that.
Absolutely, John. And on other issues, let's dig into 2024. And John, I'd be curious to know what your number one beef is right now as we move into another season.
That is so easy for me to identify. It's that free concierge service being provided for cyclists in the courtesy of the city of Victoria. No complaint from me that they have this service to keep bikes safe. I use it. I love it. But we hear from folks from different parties that the cyclists don't want to pay anything for this service. And that annoys me. That gets my goat. I published my views recently on a podcast and got quite the reaction, I might say. For example, leading cyclist advocate John Luton challenged me with several comments. He says,
"While the revenue is certainly necessary, the objective for vehicle parking charges is ensuring the scarce resources of downtown parking spots to be shared with shoppers not occupied all day for personal storage or gobbled up by downtown employees."
Okay, that's fine. This is a pretty common justification for parking charges for cars downtown over the years. But regarding the newly expanded hours for pay parking from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., I've maintained and indicated and stated that this strategy has evolved over time to a blatant cash grab to pay for bloated public spending. Meantime, cyclists get a free ride and free supervised storage. Mr. Luton says to this about the free concierge service.
"The objective is to encourage use by cyclists. If barriers like fees are created, this will push people to limit their travel to downtown, encourage them to use other means of transportation, or have them locking up their bikes to things they should not be attached to."
Right? Don't get fatigued with me yet. My final word on this is, I maintain that we're far beyond the need to be innovative to encourage folks to use bikes instead of their cars. For gosh sakes, I'm using a bike. There's been an explosion of bike usage, huge adoption of bike lane infrastructure, and even a growing acceptance of climate change mitigation strategies. But Robin, we now need a more mature cycling protocol. I believe it's time to start charging users for concierge services to protect their valuable assets, i.e. bikes, while at the same time helping to pay for policing and other services to deal with exploding property and business theft in downtown Victoria. We all share in this. And frankly, if motorists need to pay for parking, people on bikes need to also do their part.
I'm so glad you got this off your chest, John. I think this is great. And, lots of communities.
It needed to happen, Robin.
It had to happen. It had to happen. We blasted out of 2024 with a cannon. And issues like this, people need to keep their eyes peeled. We'll see how this follows. And we'll follow along here on the Rumble Room to see how this goes. And there's lots of other issues we're also going to be looking at as we move into this new year, like the future of our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. He doesn't face the voters in 2025, but does he have time? Does he still have time to turn things around? He's really been sagging in the polls. hard to see at this point, but you never know. Politics is still the long game. And we'll keep our eyes on that. And moving to the South for a moment, we're also nervously looking at what's going on with Donald Trump. Will he be allowed? Will he be allowed to run for president again? And even more scary, could he possibly win? He's no friend of the Great White North, and it's really uncertain how this would affect the world and a lot of the major conflicts taking place around the globe right now.
All of us are extraordinarily nervous. You're right about that. He's made it clear, i.e. Trump, that he's not a fan of Zelensky and or Ukraine. And in the past had nice things to say about, and has always, about Vladimir Putin. So this could be a game changer in Europe if the American Republicans decide to stop supporting the Ukrainians. And what would Trump do in the Middle East? Well, that's anyone's guess right now.
You know, he always makes it sound like he can just sit down and make a deal, like he's a used car salesman, and that's how the world politics work. And I just don't think it's ever that simple. But he loves to offer simplistic solutions to complex problems, as do many other despots around the world. And, you know, simple solutions are not in store for things like, for example, the Gaza. We have the pro-Palestinian protesters across North America and in Europe marching up and down, screaming for the destruction of Israel, screaming from the river to the sea. And it's not black and white. It's not something that's going to be solved like that. They need to find a sustainable peace somehow in that terrible conflict. So we put this question to Mark Mielke from the Aristotle Foundation. That's a Western Canadian think tank. Here's what he had to say about the Gaza.
Well, I think you need leaders to arise on the Palestinian side that will do a peace treaty with Israel. So in the early 1970s and in the 1960s, no one would have thought Egypt or Jordan would have done a peace treaty with Israel. And in fact, of course, they were involved in two wars with Israel in 1967 and 1973. But by 1978, you got to the Camp David Accords, you know, where Egypt and Israel signed a peace treaty. And it's held ever since. And Jordan has a peace treaty with Israel. And you've got the Abrahamic Accords in the last several years. So I think a lot of this depends on whether some of the Arab countries and the Palestinian leaders, if you can find a Palestinian leader that is willing to do a deal with Israel rather than wish for its destruction. So Israel has shown that it's been willing to do peace treaties in exchange for security and to give up territory. I mean, Israel gave up the entire Sinai back to Egypt in a peace treaty. So it's willing to give up the Gaza Strip, I'm sure, and I would think eventually the West Bank, minus their own settlers, if they can get someone on the other side that they can trust. It would be wonderful if Gaza one day in the West Bank resembles Singapore and, you know, not a third world country where its own people are oppressed by Hamas. So, but I think the key is honestly going to be on the Palestinian side, maybe with some pressure from the other Arab countries.
Well, Robin, in the words of John Lennon, all we are saying is give peace a chance. I know that's not what it sounds like out of John Lennon's mouth, but that's certainly what it meant. There's got to be a better way to work out differences. So let's hope for a settlement in Gaza and Europe. And hope Trump doesn't get elected. Crazy to think he would come back. But the U.S. is a very divided country right now.
There's a lot of divisions around the world. And, you know, Canada has its divisions as well. These are troubled times. And they circle around all kinds of major themes that we've been dealing with. For example, the housing crisis that's still with us. How can our young people possibly afford to live in this society? And this divides us. How do we deal with this situation? How can we be fair to everyone in this society? And the crisis on our streets is also ongoing. We have the homeless. We have the addicted, the mentally ill. They are camped in tent cities. They're in old hotels. There's crime. There's a lot of unhappiness. There's a lot of misery. And we haven't found a solution. Lots of promises to solve this. But it goes on and on. And finally, what about family doctors? We still have at least one in four, if not one in five, British Columbians without a family doctor. And we've had lots of announcements about doctors graduating from medical school, half of them going now into family practice, and more foreign doctors coming. But is it coming quickly enough? Is it enough that it's really going to turn the tide? We ask Camille Curry from BC Healthcare Matters for her thoughts. Do the recent healthcare ministry announcements actually equal better services?
Yeah, well, I think that's a little bit of my problem right now, is that we hear so many announcements and so many great things that sound like they're coming, but what we're seeing on the ground is we're not seeing those things yet. And that's in where the problem always does lie, is that there can be great announcements and there can be wonderful ideas, but we also need to see them come into effect. We need to see the action take place. And we were also just hoping by now that with so many announcements, we'd also see more transparency about stuff like this. Like, how many people have been attached to physicians? How many people still remain unattached? Are waits in ER rooms improving? And so all we have to base all this on is really what the people are saying. And what they're still telling me is tragic stories.
So you're a retired doctor.
I'm a retired doctor.
And how long ago did you retire from the practice?
About 14 years ago, I retired as a hospital medical specialist. I'm not a family doctor.
So how much have you seen the medical profession change even since you retired 14 years ago?
Drastic. You can't find a doctor. When we came here about 13 years ago, we could just about find a family doctor. Someone said, register with that doctor because he has spaces. But in the last 5 years, both my wife and my own family doctors have retired, and I'm totally dependent now on a phone up a doctor to get a prescription.
So the waiting lists are still long to get in for surgeries. And just to get into emergency, you have to sit for hours. Have things changed measurably?
No, I mean, I think measurably, they've actually, in fact, gotten worse. And that's what's terrifying, is that I'm hearing from people and I'm experiencing it myself as well. Our family has a family doctor, but again, there's that timeliness component. And when my child is sick, I can't see my family doctor in a timely fashion. And so most recently, we ended up in the ER and we waited over 9 hours to have my son seen. And he's an immunocompromised child. His blood work was showing irregularities. There was concerns for inflammation, and that was still the most expedited process we could get for him that day. And I tried every other measure, contacting every urgent primary care center, calling them. None of them, in fact, had doctors on the weekend. So what I'm seeing is still a lot of suffering, a lot of questions more than answers, and a lot of despair among the people. And it's heartbreaking, frankly.
In my opinion, this has been going on for 30 years. We should have dealt with this problem 30 years ago, and it was not addressed. Everybody just shoved it off and put it off. Now it's a crisis.
So people are on waiting lists now. You can get online and put your name in to become a candidate to find a family doctor. How successfully is that process going?
Yeah, we were wondering that ourselves too, and we've participated in a couple events over the summer, and I've chatted with obviously many people throughout the fall, and what I'm finding quite astonishing is how many people are unaware of the Health Connect registry and that they should be even registering themselves on there, or some people that might have known about it aren't aware that their community has now been added to it. So I feel like somebody's really dropped the ball there. There hasn't been enough initiative making the public aware of the existence of this wait list. I do hear from people every now and again that send me a wonderful message to let me know they've been attached to someone, but they are incredibly infrequent messages. And I'm still hearing from so many people that are waiting endlessly, and they're frustrated by not knowing how long they might have to continue to wait for or what position they are on the wait list. All of this is data that could really help just inform the public, also lower people's anxiety, their stress, and it's not coming, you know. The government also got a new influx of money from the federal government. And a portion of that was that the province would commit to being more open and transparent with the public, allowing the public to have more access to their own health records. And we haven't seen any of that yet. And I'm going to be watching very closely because I think those are incredibly important commitments that this provincial government needs to keep to the people of BC.
We've been on this path, not me alone or not the Ministry of Health alone or the health authorities alone, although they play a very significant role in it, but all of us, health professionals and communities and service organizations and the professions as well. And particularly, I want to underline the important role of organizations like the nurses and nurse practitioners of BC.
Aside from doctors, there's also been big commitments about more nurse practitioners, more health professionals, more team-approached care going on throughout the communities. Are you seeing a lot of evidence of that? Are there more nurse practitioners practicing? Are they filling the gap?
You know, I haven't seen evidence of it. And that's the problem, is right now I can only base it on what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing and what I'm talking to owners of clinics and what they're informing me about. And it hasn't been evident yet. And so I would love to see the data from the Minister of Health that could show us how many new nurse practitioners are in fact here and where are they working? Are they in communities? Are they making a difference in communities? Are they in hospitals? And if they're in hospitals, what capacity are they playing in those institutions?
Your health is like a bicycle wheel. When everything's rolling smoothly, you hardly notice all the working parts. Your healthcare system is like a bicycle wheel as well. It functions best with a spoke and hub model, and at its center is the family doctor.
Every province now in Canada has schools for training and have now changed their laws to allow for physician assistants to work alongside doctors, not British Columbia.
I know, and it's alarming. It really is. It's another one of these issues that concerns me about BC falling behind and leaving the people behind. This is an amazing measure that we could bring into place quite immediately, that we could replicate the successes that we've seen in other provinces, the ways they've done things that have helped create impactful changes, and yet BC is still lagging behind on this. Then the announcement has been made that they will approve physicians' assistants to work in the ERs, and that is only the ERs, where I've come to understand from CAPA, their organization, that most of those other provinces are allowing physicians' assistants to work in communities, as well as surgical units, as well as in other components like long-term care facilities. So I'm concerned that we haven't even seen the first step take place to bring physicians' assistants actively into the ER role in BC. And I'm even more concerned about how much longer it might take to get them working in all the other sectors where they are capable of helping us so much.
I had no idea when we planned this, I had no idea that this much media would be here today. I had a feeling that they'd all be inside, but I'm really happy to see them all outside today. Oh, woo!
Family physicians are not inferior physicians. We are family doctors by choice, not by default.
Are they doing enough to get doctors in from other parts of the country and other countries in general? And the increase in training positions now at the university, is that going to make a big measurable difference? Are you forecasting in the next 5 years or 10 years, we're going to see a dramatic increase in the number of doctors per patient?
You know, it's really interesting. Like, I've done some more understanding and learning to really see how that piece plays into the crisis that we're facing, how we're training people, whether we are allowing enough people to be trained. And a stat that really jumps out to me is just that it's astonishing how few people get accepted to medical school, and then how few Canadians that actually have to choose to go abroad because they don't get into Canadian medical schools are not allowed to come back and do residency programs here in Canada. And those percentages are so small. We are talking like 1, 2, 3 percentiles for some of these application processes. And I think that's a big barrier. That is a Canadian barrier that exists that is stopping people that are born in Canada, that want to return to Canada, to be able to come back and help us address this crisis. So I have a lot of concern around that. And I still haven't on the ground seen an influx of United States doctors being able to come in with ease, or even IMGs. And so there's still a lot of concern around this. There's a lot of announcements and not too much action on the ground.
Do you think that your organization is going to rally again in a big way? You've had some very good rallies in the past at the legislature, in front of the health building. You've widened your reach into other communities than Victoria. Certainly there have been marches in various cities now, but things have been quieter because it looks like the government's listening.
We want doctors!
We want doctors!
We want
doctors!
When do we want them?
Now!
Allowed for a little bit of breathing room and time because the government did come out with a lot of announcements that we were really happy to hear, things that sounded like they could make an impactful difference. But we have been patient, we've let time go by, and I think it is time that, you know, our organization, other organizations, and residents of British Columbia need to come together again, because they need to remember that the pressure the people can bring forward is in fact often what gets us the responses and the results that we deserve and that we need.
and next year is an election.
It is, absolutely. And I think this needs to be a referendum on healthcare. This is a top concern for people in this province, people across this country, and we can only get to the changes we need if we do it together.
I need you to cheer and whistle and clap and yell loudly. So let's do this again for our legislators. How are you feeling today on BC Family Physicians Day?
So you sit in the merge for 7 long hours. Your faith in our healthcare definitely sours. A lot of doctors hoped, a lot of doctors tried to give us their best while their hands were tied. Trying to run a business with a 10-minute guide. And meanwhile, our public healthcare died.
It's so incredibly interesting to see what's happening across the province in terms of clinics closing. We've had a recent situation. There was a clinic on Shelburne. It's a clinic that I actually was using when the pandemic was underway. I didn't have a family doctor in Victoria. I was using that clinic, and now they have closed. They've closed the doors there, and the government keeps talking about turning the tide on this. Let's see if there's measurable change in 2024. We'll keep you up to date. And on that note, John, it's pretty well time to wrap up this Rumble Room.
I can't believe it. Our first show in 2024, and we're wrapping it up already. And we just keep on rumbling, don't we? Look, guys, if you want to watch us rumble on right through 2024, join our Facebook page. Listen and watch our Twitter feed. You can catch everything that we do on our YouTube page. We've now graduated to a podcast. People are listening to us as they're running, as they're eating, as they're watching TV, as they're doing all kinds of things. They're listening to the Rumble Room. We're also on TikTok, which is a fun place to hang out. And we are on Instagram. So time passes by, but nonetheless, I remain your cremation. Your cremation. Oh, that's bad. I suppose I'm not getting that old. I remain your Croatian sensation and God's gift, I think, to electric cycling. Tour de France, eat your heart out. I'm John Jurison.
At least you're not a Dalmatian, John. That's good news. And thanks for letting me on again for another year of the Magical Mystery Tour of John Jurison as we march proudly and remind people to rumble on.